So, on June 16th, 2015, the political establishment basically looked at a man coming down a golden escalator in New York City, and across the board, they just laughed.
Yeah, they really did. Just universal laughter.
Right. They saw a reality TV star pulling off this deeply orchestrated, heavily gilded PR stunt. But what they entirely failed to see was that the traditional political rule book, like the very metrics they were using to judge if someone was a viable candidate, had actually expired roughly a decade earlier.
Oh, absolutely. They were essentially evaluating a completely new kind of software using an operating system from, the 1990s.
It's crazy. And today, we're going to look at exactly how those barriers were dismantled. Welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are opening up an incredibly detailed historical overview. It's titled Dossier Trump 2015-2029, Chapter 1, The Rise of a Political Outsider. And we're focusing on those years, 2015 to 2016.
Right, the real foundational period of this whole shift.
Exactly, because we aren't just going to recount the events of that election cycle. We want to deconstruct the underlying machinery. We're trying to understand the exact sociological, economic, and technological mechanisms that allowed a completely non-traditional candidate to capture the attention and obviously the votes of millions of Americans.
And, the dossier provides just a phenomenal framework for this. It pulls together macroeconomic data, localized labor statistics, the structural evolution of the
Bunch of
media.
media stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. The early algorithmic shifts of social networks. It pulls all that together to explain this era. It moves us away from just looking at the personalities, and it forces us to look at the massive tectonic societal plates that were shifting underneath the surface.
Now, real quick, before we drop into the timeline, there is one absolute non-negotiable rule we are setting for this conversation today.
Highly important to mention.
Yes, the historical sources we are unpacking today contain intensely politically charged content. I mean, obviously. But our role here is to maintain absolute unwavering neutrality.
Right, we are entirely objective here.
Exactly. We aren't taking sides. We aren't validating right-wing or left-wing ideologies, and we certainly aren't endorsing any specific political stance. We are acting entirely as your analytical guides to the historical data provided in the source material. We just want to give you the clarity to understand how things worked during this incredibly pivotal period.
And I should probably add that understanding the mechanics of history doesn't have to be some dense, heavy chore.
No. None of
The
your get.
dynamics of how human beings organize, how they express frustration, and how communication technologies completely rewrite our culture, I mean, that is inherently fascinating stuff.
It really is. So let's step back into that timeline. June 16, 2015, Trump Tower. We have this iconic visual, right? The gold brass, the marble walls, the sheer glitz of a Manhattan billionaire's skyscraper.
It's quite the stage.
Very much so. Donald J. Trump comes down that escalator and announces he is running for president of the United States. And as we established earlier, the immediate reaction from the established political class, the media elites, international observers, it was nearly universal dismissal.
Right. And to really understand that dismissal, we have to look at the established criteria for a presidential candidate at that specific time. Up until that exact moment, the presidency was viewed as the absolute final rung on a very specific, heavily guarded career ladder.
You had to put in the time.
Exactly. You should have started in local politics or law, moved to a governorship or a seat in the Senate, built a massive network of establishment donors, and demonstrated a mastery of highly nuanced, often incredibly dry policy language.
Right, you basically had to speak Washington, you had to know all the acronyms, you had to have the white papers ready to go, and you definitely needed the blessing of the party elders.
You did. And then, well, you look at Donald Trump's profile in 2015. He didn't just lack that traditional resume. His entire public persona was built in direct opposition to it.
Yeah, completely opposite.
He was a real estate developer whose brand was synonymous with excess and luxury. He was the author of The Art of the Deal. And crucially, for over a decade, he had been the central star of The Apprentice.
Right, a reality television show.
Yeah, a show where his primary catchphrase was, "You're fired." I mean, he was a celebrity, a brand manager, and an entertainer.
So, from the perspective of a seasoned political strategist, sitting in a war room somewhere in Washington, D.C., looking at this guy from reality TV walking onto their turf, it actually makes total sense why they wouldn't take him seriously.
It does. It absolutely does.
Okay, let's unpack this with an analogy. It's like a reality TV star walking onto the chessboard of a grandmaster tournament. Everyone assumes they don't even know how the knight moves, so they just completely ignore them.
That is a perfect way to look at it. The political ecosystem has this built-in immune system, and usually that immune system attacks foreign bodies, you know, new candidates, with opposition research, policy critiques, negative advertising.
The standard playbook.
Exactly. But the immune system didn't trigger here because the establishment didn't recognize him as a threat. They thought he was a court jester who would command a few weeks of tabloid headlines, boost his brand, and quietly drop out before the actual voting even started.
Which, wait, that brings up a really interesting mechanical question. If no one in the political elite expected him to win the nomination, let alone the presidency, did their initial dismissal actually give him the unprotected runway he needed to take off?
Oh, without a doubt. The dossier highlights this exact dynamic. Because he was dismissed as a stunt, he wasn't immediately subjected to that coordinated millions of dollars in attack ads phase that usually destroys outsider campaigns early on.
Wow, so they basically gave him a free pass at the start.
They left the door completely unlocked. They operated under the assumption that lack of political experience was this fatal flaw that the voters would just naturally reject. But what they entirely missed was that for a massive growing demographic in the country, that lack of experience wasn't a liability at all.
It was a feature, not a bug.
Right. It was his strongest asset.
Because, think about it, if you fundamentally believe the system is broken, the absolute last person you want to hire to fix it is someone whose entire resume was built inside that broken system.
Precisely. And to truly understand why that anti-system sentiment was so overwhelmingly powerful in 2015, the historians in our dossier tell us we have to look away from the gleaming Trump Tower.
Right.
We have to look at the ground conditions across the country in the decade leading up to that announcement.
Yeah, we have to look at what the source material calls America before Trump. Because, as we know, you don't get an earthquake without decades of pressure building up along the fault lines.
Exactly.
And the picture the data paints of the early 2010s is essentially this tale of two entirely different economies coexisting and completely ignoring each other within the exact same borders.
Yeah. Let's look at the macroeconomic data following the 2008 financial crisis. If you were sitting in a high-rise in New York or a government office in D.C., you were looking at spreadsheets that told a very comforting story of recovery.
Everything was bouncing back.
Right. The stock market had not only recovered from the crash, but was hitting historical highs. The national unemployment rate was steadily dropping. The gross domestic product, the GDP, was growing.
So by all the normal measures, things were fine.
By the traditional metrics that economists had used for a century, the crisis was over. The engine of American capitalism was humming perfectly.
So what does this all mean? It sounds like the national economic dashboard was flashing green, but for millions of people, their personal engine was sputtering and smoking.
That analogy hits the nail on the head, because while the national averages look so healthy, the lived reality in specific geographic regions, most notably the industrial Midwest, the so-called Rust Belt.
Right. Places like Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Exactly. Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. In these areas, they were experiencing a slow-motion economic collapse. The dossier breaks down the mechanics of this beautifully. In these regions, a rising stock market meant absolutely nothing.
Because they didn't own stock. They owned their labor.
Exactly. And their labor was being systematically devalued. The source material points to the compounding effects of globalization and automation. Trade policies that were designed to make consumer goods cheaper, you know, like the integration of China into the World Trade Organization and the North American Free Trade Agreement.
NAFTA.
Yeah, NAFTA. These had a devastating localized cost. It meant that a factory paying a middle-class wage in Ohio simply couldn't compete with a factory paying pennies on the dollar overseas.
Right. So the factory closes. And I want to pause here because, you know, it's easy to just say a factory closes and move on to the next statistic. But based on the sociological data in the dossier, we really need to understand the cascading mechanism of that closure.
It's massive.
When the auto parts plant with 2,000 workers shuts down, it doesn't just mean 2,000 people are looking for work.
No. It hollows out the entire municipal ecosystem. When those 2,000 paychecks disappear, the local diner closes because nobody is buying lunch anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The hardware store goes under. Then the local tax base collapses.
Oh, man. So the city itself goes broke?
Suddenly, the town can't afford to pave the roads, fund the schools, or pay the police and fire departments. The youth, anyone with the means to leave, moves away to the coastal cities. You are left with an aging population, plummeting property values, and a profound sense of communal despair.
And what's crucial is the timeline here, right? This wasn't a sudden disaster like a hurricane or a flood. This was a slow, agonizing bleed over 15 years.
A slow bleed, yes. And while that bleed was happening, what were these communities hearing from the traditional institutions? They would turn on their televisions and hear politicians from both major parties, Wall Street executives, traditional media anchors, all talking about the incredible benefits of global free trade.
They were basically being told that the economy was recovering.
Exactly.
So you have this massive cognitive dissonance. You're living in this town. You are looking at a boarded up Main Street. You are making half of what you made 10 years ago. And the people in power are literally patting themselves on the back for a job well done.
And this is the core mechanism of the trust deficit that the dossier emphasizes. This wasn't just typical political grumbling about taxes being too high.
Right, it was much deeper than that.
This was a structural collapse in institutional trust. The populations in these industrial regions began to view Washington, Wall Street, multinational corporations, and the traditional news media not just as out of touch, but as actively complicit in their decline.
They felt like they were being sold out.
They felt that the rules of the global economy had been rigged by the elites for the elites.
But let me ask you this. Why were the political elites so blind to this localized pain when the national numbers look so good? I just struggle to believe that they were completely 100% blind to it. Didn't they have internal polling? Didn't the strategists see the anger bubbling up in these specific counties?
Well, they saw the data, sure. But cognitive dissonance works on elites, too. The establishment politicians were deeply, deeply committed to the economic consensus of the era. They genuinely believed that free trade and global interconnectivity were a rising tide that would eventually lift all boats.
Right.
So when they saw the localized pain in the Rust Belt, they categorized it as an unfortunate but temporary side effect of a necessary transition to a service and information economy. They offered retraining programs or suggested people move to where the tech jobs were.
Which, honestly, to a 55-year-old former steelworker whose entire family history is rooted in a specific town, that sounds incredibly condescending. Just learn to code and move to California.
It was perceived as deeply arrogant. And this created the perfect, highly combustible atmospheric conditions. You have millions of voters carrying deep, profound economic anxiety.
Fear of foreign competition, fear of automation.
Yes, the reality of stagnant wages.
Right.
And you have a political class speaking a sanitized language of macroeconomics that completely ignores that anxiety.
And I want you, the listener, to consider this for a second. Think about how often you see news about a quote-unquote booming economy while you're personally feeling the pinch at the grocery store or at the gas pump.
It's incredibly relatable.
It makes this historical economic disconnect highly understandable. You get why they were angry.
Absolutely.
Which brings us to the summer of 2015, the Republican primaries. You have this massive powder keg of resentment sitting in the middle of the country, and into the arena steps our non-traditional outsider.
Donald Trump.
Right. Now, he wasn't running unopposed. The dossier details that he entered a Republican primary field that was historically crowded. There were 16 other major candidates.
It was a packed stage.
And this wasn't a weak bench. These were sitting governors from major states, highly respected long-term senators, former cabinet ministers. This was the absolute A-list of the traditional Republican Party apparatus.
And again, the mechanical assumption of the political science world was that Trump would serve as a minor distraction before the voters got serious. The established theory of primaries suggests that eventually voters coalesce around the most electable, experienced candidate.
The safe bet.
Right. The party bosses assumed the sheer gravity and funding of the establishment candidates would just push the reality TV star right out of orbit.
But the exact opposite happened. He didn't just survive the early rounds, he systematically dismantled an entire stage of seasoned politicians.
Yeah.
I want to dig into the how here, because if I am one of those frustrated voters in the Rust Belt, why do I choose the billionaire from Manhattan over a governor who has actually balanced a state budget? What was the mechanical difference in his campaign strategy?
It came down to a complete overhaul of the communication strategy. Traditional candidates, you know, they're trained to speak in a very specific, highly mitigated way. They use focus groups language.
Very correct.
Exactly. If you ask a traditional senator about trade, they will give you a four-part answer about tariff schedules, bilateral agreements, and long-term geopolitical stability. It's careful, it's dry, and it's specifically designed to avoid offending anyone.
Right. It's designed to survive a Sunday morning political talk show without making a gaffe.
Precisely. Trump, on the other hand, entirely abandoned that playbook. He communicated with incredibly simple, blunt and highly emotional messaging.
He didn't offer a nuanced critique of the World Trade Organization.
No, not at all. He stood at the podium, pointed at the cameras, and said, "They are stealing our jobs, our leaders are stupid, and I am going to stop it."
He basically stripped all the academic filter off the anger.
He spoke directly to the visceral anxieties that Dossier outlined. Immigration, the loss of manufacturing jobs, the perceived decline of national pride, and the need for hard security. These are not complex policy white papers. They are gut-level emotional appeals. And to the voters who felt ignored by the polished politicians, this bluntness sounded like authenticity.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because there's another layer to this primary dominance that the source material points out, and it revolves around the media.
Yes, the earned media strategy.
Right. The dossier notes that Trump employed an earned media strategy that was virtually unprecedented. Can you explain the mechanics of how that actually worked?
Yeah, so earned media is a term for the free airtime a candidate gets on the news as opposed to paid advertising. Traditional candidates have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on television commercials to get their message out.
It's incredibly expensive to run for president.
Extremely. But Trump realized that if he said something highly controversial, something that completely broke the traditional rules of political decorum, the news networks would cover him continuously for 48 hours.
Because outrage drives ratings.
It's exactly. The financial model of cable news relies on keeping viewers engaged, and nothing engages human psychology faster than conflict and controversy. Whenever Trump insulted a rival, attacked a sacred political cow, or proposed a radical idea, the networks would host panels analyzing it, condemning it, and debating it.
So it was just nonstop coverage.
Nonstop. The dossier actually estimates he received billions of dollars in free earned media coverage simply by dominating the daily narrative.
Wow. So did the traditional media inadvertently act as his primary campaign manager? By covering every controversy, did they hand him the microphone he needed to reach the exact voters who hated the media? I mean, if you are a senator trying to give a speech on tax reform, but every network is playing a clip of Trump insulting someone, you literally can't get your message to the voters.
You are completely drowned out. And the traditional gatekeepers, the party leaders, the editorial boards of major newspapers, they assumed that their constant condemnation of Trump would eventually disqualify him in the eyes of the voters.
But they forgot about the trust deficit.
Exactly. This is where the concept of negative partisanship comes into play. Because that massive segment of voters had entirely lost faith in the traditional media and the political establishment, condemnation from those groups no longer acted as a deterrent.
It was almost a badge of honor.
In fact, it acted as an endorsement. If the newspaper you fundamentally believe is lying to you writes an editorial saying a candidate is dangerous, you immediately assume that candidate must be doing something right. The establishment's attacks served as his strongest validation.
It is a complete 180-degree inversion of the rules of political physics. The harder the traditional system pushed against him, the stronger he became.
It's fascinating.
But his media strategy wasn't just about dominating television screens. It was about leveraging a relatively new technology to bypass the media filter entirely. Which brings us to the technological revolution of this era, governing by Twitter.
A huge paradigm shift.
The source material is emphatic about this. No previous presidential candidate had ever used social media as effectively. Twitter became his primary political instrument.
To really appreciate this shift, you have to look at the history of how presidents have communicated. FDR used the radio to bypass the newspapers with his fireside chats. JFK understood the visual power of television. Obama pioneered the use of big data and micro-targeting in 2008.
Right.
But Trump's use of Twitter fundamentally altered the speed and the architecture of political discourse.
Let's break down the mechanics of the platform itself. Because in 2015, Twitter was still relatively new as a primary political battleground. What was it about the actual structure of a 140-character tweet that made it such a devastatingly effective political tool for this specific candidate?
It comes down to friction and gatekeeping. Before social media, if a candidate wanted to make a statement, they had to draft a press release, send it to reporters, wait for the reporters to write a story, and hope the editor decided to put it on the front page or the evening broadcast.
So many hurdles.
Right. There was a massive layer of editorial friction. Twitter completely eliminated that friction. It provided a direct, unfiltered conduit straight to the pockets of millions of voters. If a traditional newspaper decided not to cover a specific angle, it didn't matter. The candidate could simply bypass them and broadcast directly.
Okay, an analogy for you. It's like replacing a carefully edited daily newspaper with a live megaphone broadcasting directly into millions of living rooms at 3 a.m.
That is exactly what it was like.
And the speed of that is crucial, right? The dossier talks about how he was able to dictate the daily news cycle before the other campaigns even had their morning coffee.
Yes, he utilized a media theory known as agenda setting. The press doesn't necessarily tell people what to think, but it tells them what to think about.
Oh, that's interesting.
By firing off a provocative tweet at 6 a.m., Trump forced the entire media ecosystem to spend the rest of the day reacting to his premise. The traditional campaigns, with their slow, committee-based approval processes for public statements, they were constantly playing defense. They were always reacting, never leading.
But this introduces a massive debate that the historians in our dossier are still grappling with, the dual nature of this technological shift. Let's look at the two opposing views.
The source outlines them very clearly. On one hand, proponents and supporters viewed this use of social media as the ultimate democratization of politics.
Power to the people.
Exactly. For decades, the political narrative was tightly controlled by a handful of coastal editors, television producers, and party bosses. Twitter shattered that monopoly. It allowed a leader to speak with an authentic, unvarnished voice directly to the citizens. It felt transparent. It felt like, finally, the curtain had been pulled back.
But the critics and the sociologists analyzing the data saw a much darker structural shift.
They did. The critics warned that the very architecture of social media platforms like Twitter inherently degrades the quality of civic discourse. The algorithms that power these platforms are designed to maximize user engagement.
Keep you scrolling.
Right. And psychological studies clearly show that the emotions that drive the highest engagement, the fastest clicks, the most retweets, are anger and moral outrage.
Nuance is basically boring to an algorithm.
Exactly. You cannot explain the intricacies of a bilateral trade agreement or the complexities of healthcare reform in 140 characters, but you can very easily launch a devastating personal attack, spread a catchy slogan, or amplify a grievance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
The critics argued that this medium shifted the political currency away from facts, context, and policy, and replaced it with emotion, speed, and viral outrage.
So let me ask a structural question here. Did social media just accelerate existing political anger? Or did the medium itself fundamentally change the nature of the message? Did Twitter actually create the anger that fueled the 2016 election?
The dossier's analysis suggests it was really a synthesis of both. The profound economic and cultural grievances were absolutely real and pre-existing.
Like we talked about with the Rust Belt.
Right, the dry tinder was there.
Mm-hmm.
But the social media algorithm was the accelerant. It connected isolated pockets of frustration, validated them, and amplified them to a national scale instantly.
Wow.
Regardless of whether you view it as a triumph of democratization or the death of nuanced debate, the source is clear. Social media permanently changed the metabolism of American politics. The era of the slow, carefully curated intellectual campaign was officially dead.
And I challenge you, the listener, to reflect on this for a second. Think about how your own consumption of news has shifted over the last decade. From long-form reading to instant, emotionally charged scrolling, it really changes how you process information.
It absolutely rewires how we engage with the world.
It really does. So this potent mix of anti-establishment populism, economic promises, and unfiltered social media communication, it set the stage for the ultimate showdown. Which brings us to the 2016 campaign and the November shockwave.
A general election.
Exactly. Donald Trump secures the Republican nomination, much to the absolute horror of the party establishment, and he faces off against the Democrat nominee, Hillary Clinton. And according to the historical overview, this became one of the most polarized elections in modern American history.
It wasn't just a race between two politicians. It was a clash of two entirely different realities.
Right. Because Hillary Clinton represented the ultimate distillation of the traditional political establishment. Her resume was the exact blueprint we discussed earlier.
She was a former first lady, a two-term senator from New York, a former secretary of state.
Mm-hmm.
She had decades of deep governmental experience, immense policy knowledge, and the backing of the traditional institutional power structures.
She was the ultimate insider.
And Trump ran a campaign entirely built on the premise that the insiders were the ones who had destroyed the country. The dossier reiterates his core pillars: economic frustrations, immigration, national identity, and a deep, deep distrust of elites.
His narrative remained incredibly disciplined in its simplicity. The system no longer works for ordinary Americans. He promised to bring back jobs, renegotiate trade treaties, and protect American industry.
While the Clinton campaign was running on a message of steady, competence, continuity, and incremental progress, Trump was basically running as a human wrecking ball aimed at the establishment. He was promising to tear up NAFTA and punish corporations that move jobs overseas.
And if we look at the predictive data, the traditional polling leading up to Election Day.
The models.
Yeah, the models. The wrecking ball wasn't supposed to win.
No, the traditional metrics used by political scientists and pollsters, state-by-state polling averages, campaign fundraising totals, the size of a candidate's ground game, they almost universally pointed toward a Clinton victory.
They thought she had it locked up.
The models predicted that the sheer weight of traditional campaign infrastructure and demographic trends would easily repel this populist insurgency.
And then, November 8th, 2016, election night. I want to drill down into the specific mechanics of what actually happened, because he didn't just win, he succeeded in states traditionally not considered Republican. He broke a very specific geographical barrier called the Blue Wall. Explain what that was and why it mattered so much.
So, the Blue Wall referred to a block of states, specifically Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, that had reliably voted for the Democratic presidential candidate in every election since 1992.
So decades.
Decades. They were considered the impregnable foundation of any Democratic Electoral College victory. But remember the economic data we discussed from the beginning of the dossier?
The localized pain of globalization.
Yes, the shuttered factories, the hollowing out of the middle class. Those three states are the absolute heart of the industrial rust belt.
Ah. So while the national polls were looking at aggregate popularity, the Trump campaign's hyper-focused emotional message about renegotiating trade was acting like a laser cutting directly through the bricks of that blue wall.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. On November 8, Donald Trump flipped Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin by razor-thin margins.
Wow.
The voters in those regions, many of whom had previously voted for Barack Obama, crossed party lines because the populist anti-establishment economic message resonated deeper than traditional party loyalty. He won enough electoral votes to become the 45th president of the United States.
The source material contrasts the reactions to this victory, and it is a fascinating study in societal polarization.
It really is.
For his supporters, November 8 was a night of ultimate vindication. It was historical proof that ordinary citizens, the forgotten men and women, could rise up and successfully challenge a rigged political and media establishment that had mocked and ignored them for decades.
And for his opponents, and honestly, the global political establishment, the reaction was profound, existential shock. It was a shocking warning about the fragility of traditional political assumptions. The models were wrong. The guardrails hadn't held.
Now, we often hear about quote-unquote unprecedented moments in history. But given the specific economic and cultural powder keg the sources describe, I have to ask, was this victory actually a shock, or was it an entirely predictable outcome that the polls just failed to measure?
That is a brilliant analytical question. And looking at the data retroactively, it leans heavily toward predictable. The polling industry suffered from severe structural blind spots. They failed to accurately weight the voting intentions of non-college educated white voters in rural and industrial areas.
They just missed them in the data.
Yes, and they also likely encountered a social desirability bias.
What's that?
It's where some voters, knowing the media heavily stigmatized the candidate, simply refused to tell pollsters who they were actually voting for.
Oh, they lied to the pollsters.
Exactly. The underlying forces, the economic resentment, the institutional distrust were all there, clearly visible in the sociological data. The shock wasn't that the conditions existed. The shock was the profound arrogance of the political class, who were so insulated in their own echo chambers that they couldn't conceive of a world where their consensus was rejected.
And that rejection, it didn't just rattle the windows in Washington, D.C., it immediately rippled out across the globe. Which brings us to our final analytical segment, global reactions and the big picture. Because the morning of November 9, 2016, the entire geopolitical landscape woke up to a new reality.
The dossier explicitly states that the 2016 election instantly took on massive global significance. The post-Cold War international order was built on a series of assumptions.
Like what?
That the United States would always champion global free trade, that it would always fiercely maintain the NATO military alliance, and that it would prioritize international multilateral cooperation.
And suddenly, a president was elected on an America First platform.
Exactly. European governments were scrambling. They were trying to figure out what this meant for NATO, trade relations, and international cooperation. Would the U.S. withdraw from trade treaties? Would it demand protection money for military alliances?
It's like the anchor of the global system just decided to detach itself and float away.
It caused absolute panic in traditional circles.
But it wasn't just the establishment governments reacting. The dossier points out the ripple effect this had on global populism.
Yes, that is a massive part of the story. Around the world, populist movements saw Trump's victory as a profound inspiration. If an insurgent outsider could topple the elite establishment in the United States, it could be done anywhere.
A huge proof of concept.
It served as massive inspiration for movements advocating for tighter borders, economic protectionism, and a rejection of globalist policies. Conversely, traditional centrist parties viewed 2016 as a dire warning.
Adapt or die, basically.
Exactly. They realized they were highly vulnerable if they didn't address the underlying anxieties of their working classes.
This brings us to the ultimate thesis of our source material. The dossier concludes that 2016 was a massive turning point in modern politics, breaking those post-Cold War assumptions.
It proved several uncomfortable truths.
Right. It proved that globalization was not universally loved. It proved that traditional parties were highly vulnerable. It showed that social media had fundamentally altered political communication. And it demonstrated that cultural identity was playing an increasingly massive role in elections.
Which leads to what the dossier calls the historical question. Even up to 2029, political scientists are debating this. Was Donald Trump a temporary deviation or a symptom of deeper societal changes?
That's a great question.
It is. If you connect this to the bigger picture, does focusing too much on the personality of one individual blind us to the massive tectonic plates shifting underneath our society?
Let me use an analogy here. It's the difference between a sudden thunderstorm and a permanent shift in the climate. The experts in 2029 are still debating which one 2016 was.
And the dossier's conclusion is that he was really both a cause and a symptom of broader shifts. The economic uncertainty, the cultural change, the growing polarization. He was a unique catalyst adapted to the new media environment. But the societal conditions were the dry tinder waiting to be lit.
Right. If we focus entirely on the spark, we completely miss the massive structural shifts that dictate history. And that is a phenomenal lens through which to view the incredible journey we just took through chapter one of this dossier. Let's just take a breath and briefly recap what we've unpacked today.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We started with the escalator stunt that no one took seriously. We dove deep into the underlying economic discontent in the Rust Belt, exploring how the macro recovery masked a localized depression.
We examined how that trust deficit allowed an outsider to bypass traditional norms, weaponizing simple messaging to dismantle a crowded field of traditional candidates in the primary.
We analyzed the revolutionary use of Twitter, breaking the media filter.
And finally, we explored the shocking victory on November 8, 2016, and the fundamental realignment of global politics.
It is a staggering amount of historical machinery to comprehend, but the story, obviously, does not end on election night. In fact, the hardest part was just beginning. Which brings me to a sneak peek for you. In our next deep dive, we are going to open up chapter two, the redefining of the presidency. We're covering 2017 to 2021.
It's going to be a fascinating follow-up.
Absolutely. We will explore how Trump not only changed policy, but the very expectations of how a president behaves. We'll be analyzing his governance via social media, the fierce conflicts with the press, the first impeachment, his personal foreign diplomacy, and ultimately the defining crisis of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Seeing how this new outsider paradigm handled a global pandemic is going to be incredibly revealing.
You absolutely will not want to miss it. But before we sign off today, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought, something that wasn't discussed today but builds directly on everything we just explored. Think about the word outsider. Before 2015, an outsider was someone who lacked the experience to govern. It was a liability. Today, I want you to ask yourself, has the definition of outsider completely flipped? In today's world, is being a political insider actually the biggest liability a candidate can have?
That completely reframes how we look at future elections.
It really does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the information around you, and we will see you for chapter two.